Hello, I am the host of Shifting Culture, Joshua Johnson. I just want to come on before the episode and tell you all thank you for listening. Did you know that big things are coming for Shifting Culture and you can be a part of it? We have just launched a Patreon. When you become a monthly patron to the show, you will get our episode ad-free, get early access to episodes, be able to download episode guides, and get bonus shows. Go to patreon.com/shiftingculture to support all that we are doing. Your support means that we can continue to help the body of Christ look more like Jesus. Again, go to patreon.com/shiftingculture. Thank you so much. Now, on to the episode.
Even the idea of like church vision, what does that even mean if you're trying to activate the priesthood of all believers? Vision is like one leader, like the lead mega global pastor, you know, they're the ones that get to listen to Jesus about their sense of calling. They get to go up the mountain and hear from the Lord. And then they codify that sense of calling into a vision statement. And then they're just trying to align thousands of people to that one vision. So nobody else gets to hear from Jesus. And if they do, and they hear a sense of calling that diverges somehow from this one sense of calling, well, you got to go find somewhere else, you know? So even our sense of like who gets to have a vision, how that vision integrates or doesn't integrate with the sort of scope of the community and our aspirations around alignment, that all gets messy, and it has to be completely rethought. You know, it has to be, you got to count the cost and really negotiate like how chaotic are we willing to get, and what are the things we're willing to let go of.
Hello, and welcome to the Shifting Culture podcast, in which we have conversations about the culture we create and the impact we can make. We long to see the body of Christ look like Jesus. I'm your host, Joshua Johnson. Go to shiftingculturepodcast.com to interact and donate. And don't forget to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast app to be notified when new episodes come out each week. And go leave a rating and review. It's easy, it only takes a second, and it helps us find new listeners to the show. Just go to the show page on the app that you're using right now and hit 5 stars. Thank you so much. You know what else would help us out? Share this podcast with your friends, your family, your network. Tell them how much you enjoy it. Let them know that they should be listening as well. If you're new here, welcome. If you want to dig deeper, find us on social media at Shifting Culture Podcast, where I post video clips and quotes and interact with all of you. Previous guests on the show have included Alan Hirsch, Rob Wegner, and Bree Mills. You can go back, listen to those amazing episodes and more. But today's guest is Lucas Pulley. Lucas is executive director of Underground Network, an experimental community made up of over 160 microchurches in Tampa Bay and serving dozens of similar decentralized and empowering movements around the world. Lucas has 14 years of experience planting microchurches and leading decentralized networks of grassroots churches, and he still leads a neighborhood house church in the projects of inner city Tampa to this day with his wife and 3 kids. He is driven to see cities transformed by the priesthood of all believers activated in the mission of God. Lucas and I have a great conversation around microchurches and decentralized church networks. Lucas shares his story of how he got involved in microchurches and how they operate. We talk about having an ecclesial minimum of worship, community, and mission. We talk about microchurches that can be mission-specific around a calling or distributive with people following various callings. We talk about the importance of connecting microchurches through area collectives and larger events, the need to move through the spaces of belonging, and insights into preventing heresy and abuse through governance structures while still allowing for messiness and the priesthood of all believers. So, join us as we discover what God is doing through microchurches. Here is my conversation with Lucas Pulley. Lucas, welcome to Shifting Culture. Really excited to have you on. I've been meaning to do this for at least a couple of years, so thanks for joining me.
Of course. It's great to be on. I have my coffee. I'm ready to record a 6-hour podcast interview. That's the typical mode here, right?
It's typical. Yeah, 6 hours. You get going. And that's good. I just recommended a podcast to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And yeah. There are some episodes of it, of just the history of it, mm-hmm. are like 6 hours long. And they're like, 6 hours? What's going on? They're like, yes, this is what
Let's go.
History podcast. But hopefully this isn't going to be a 6 hour long conversation. Well, Lucas, I'd love to get into your story of how you started to get involved in microchurch and why microchurch is for you.
Yeah, so I started, this would have been maybe 2006, 2007. I started following Jesus right before I went to college, like the month before I went to college. And I was born and raised in Illinois, central Illinois area. And I've had a great family. I've got parents that are believers, and they had me around the church, you know, for most of my life. But I was never really committed to the church. I wasn't really a committed follower of Jesus. I wasn't thinking about what the church was or how it operated. I was just sort of around it here and there. But I started following Jesus really seriously right before I went to college. And then in college, got connected to a campus ministry and was discipled really well by an older guy in the faith. And from the very early days of my like spiritual life was being trained as a missionary, you know, I was like 2 months a believer, and it was like, yeah, what God has done for you. And I had, you know, I came out of a pretty rough, life and situation. So it was sort of like, yeah, like the healing and restoration that you've experienced, you can like extend that to other people. So this, even in the campus world, was thinking how incarnationally and how to plant Bible studies in dorm buildings and how to make disciples and how to share your faith and all that stuff. And at the same time, you know, was that campus ministry was encouraging us, you know, as a good parachurch, you know, they were like, we're not really your church body. You should be trying to plug into a church, local church body. And so we would go to Sunday morning churches, and I was sort of having a hard time. It felt like my campus ministry life experience felt more true to the New Testament than what we were doing on Sunday mornings, which felt sort of dissonant or, you know, felt a little bit distant from the pages of the New Testament. And so I was just sort of like wrestling with that in college. And, you know, and then when we were seniors and we'd been leading the campus ministry for a couple years and trying to reach the campus, all that kind of stuff. We started doing city ministry, like around the campus. We started doing ministry in the community around the campus. And by the end of this group of seniors in college that had been in this leadership team together, by the end of that year, we were running a daily dinner kitchen for the poorest in our city. We were doing a discovery Bible study in that daily dinner kitchen. Different people would take turns sort of leading it. We were sort of just in community with the poor. And then on Wednesday nights, we were doing like a prison ministry. And then there was all these single moms that we had gotten connected to that had their own set of needs. And that sort of became this own autonomous sort of ministry thing. And then we were doing street church Bible studies in front yards. And there was sort of this mess of ministry. Now, we didn't have the language of microchurch. We didn't have the language of decentralized network, you know, it wasn't called anything. It was just like this mess of it was barely networked at all. And, but we all sort of felt collectively like we sort of had this couple months of prayer together as a team. Like, what are we supposed to do when we graduate? Because we were just sort of like, I'm not sure if we're just supposed to like graduate and go get jobs and like abandon what we've experienced here in this town. And so that whole leadership team decided, we just felt led by the Lord, like we're supposed to stay in this town and get whatever jobs we can, but we're supposed to not choose our occupations. We're supposed to choose each other and this place that we've been doing fruitful ministry in. And so we stayed and then we bought houses and then we were doing house church stuff and we were doing intentional community and asset-based community development in certain neighborhoods of the city. And it just kept getting like more and more sort of chaotic. And that thing eventually became a sister movement in the underground network. You know, we got 3 or 4 years into the story of that thing, like around 2012. I just felt like we were making a lot of preventable mistakes, but we needed leadership. We needed somebody to learn from. But there we didn't have a lot of local. We had a great relationship with local churches, but those local churches knew that we couldn't learn from them. They couldn't really teach us based on what we were trying to do. And so that's how we got connected through a myriad of events to Tampa Underground. And I've came and stayed with Tampa Underground for like a month and did like an immersive. And then they sent some leaders up to live in Illinois with our community for some time to see what we were doing. And that started our friendship. And we eventually became one of the sister movements in the Underground Network. But that was just like a software update for us. We were like, oh, minimal ecclesiology and microchurches and decentralized network and calling being the catalyst for microchurch growth. And you don't really start microchurches. You plant mission. You plant the gospel through incarnational missionaries. You see if the church may emerge in God's plan and timing. And that was all stuff that we were intuitively doing, but we weren't sure if we were heretics or not. You know, like and we didn't have language for it. We didn't have a lot of training around it. It was just all intuitive. So it's hugely helpful for us. So the long story short is like I just sort of stumbled into microchurch life as really my first and primary experience of church. You know, I didn't have a lot to disentangle from. I didn't have to shift something. I mean, I was like a believer for a handful of months, and this guy was discipling me, and I was just asking him like, hey, if I just wanted to read some stuff, like if I just got into reading, what are some books you'd recommend? And he put Forgotten Ways by Alan Hirsch in my hands. Like I was like 3 months a believer, you know?
And here you go. This is what we're doing.
How we go.
That's awesome. Really, what's the tension between intuition and actually doing what the Spirit is leading you to do, and then knowledge and understanding, language for what you have, and structure to get that done? How can you keep both of those and hold those in tension? And what's the importance of both?
Yeah, I mean, we were definitely in the early days, and we even still see this now, you know, leading a network of microchurches, but everybody being in their own place in their journey, so that we run into a lot of leaders that are just doing things intuitively. They don't yet have a lot of language or theological framework for it. But essentially what that intuition was always, for at least in our story, that intuition was always actually just grounded in an encounter with the Lord in the scriptures, right? It wasn't like, I don't know, pragmatic intuition or strategic intuition. It was like, we're just soaking in the scriptures together as a community, and we're really trying to be attuned to the Spirit, you know, both in our soaking in the scriptures, but also just in life, like walking in prayer without ceasing, and in some kind of like listening to trying to pay attention to what God is doing in the city and join in. Like, we don't actually go do anything. We just try to look for what God is doing, and we join in. We look for who he's stirring and awakening. We look for what evils or social issues in the city are sort of emerging, as like the kingdom is sort of invading those things and sending workers to those things. So the intuition was always actually like emerging from an attunement with the Spirit, a soaking in the scriptures. But yeah, I mean, eventually the problem there, the downside there, is when it stays intuition. Maybe another word for intuition would be unconscious competence. You know, like you're doing a thing, but you can't actually describe to another what that thing is because you're sort of doing it unconsciously. And unconscious competence is great, but anything that you're unconsciously competent in, you actually cannot pass on to another, so it dies with your generation. And so the helpful thing about language frameworks, like getting some organization or whatever, a lot of that stuff, basically clarifying the intuition in language and in theological frameworks that are true to it. A lot of that work is essentially moving from unconsciously competent to consciously competent. Like, we can actually describe with words and frameworks and tools what's happening here. So then you can actually pass it on from generation to generation. You know, like you can actually train toward that, coach toward that, share it, diffuse DNA you know, through a community that can live on. But of course, like you said, that's a tension, because if you overcorrect and then you close your fist around the tools and the frameworks and all that kind of stuff, and people are actually no longer listen to the spirit and soak in the scriptures, they memorize tools and frameworks, well, then you the movement of the spirit's going to die anyway. You'll actually go on a track toward becoming unconsciously incompetent at certain things. You know, you yeah. think you're doing it well, and mm-hmm. you're not really.
So is that something that you can start to train for, is to be attuned to the spirit, to see what God is doing in an area and to see what are the problems in our place? And then how do you structure then a micro church around those sort of things to actually accomplish something that God is yeah. doing, or join him in what he's doing?
Yeah. I mean, we do our best to try to attempt to train people toward, I'm not even sure if training is the right word, but yeah, help equip people toward a concern for listening to Jesus for their sense of calling and missionary destiny. To whom have you been sent? And I think that it's both like a sense of, people have different words for that, right? A sense of passion, a sense of destiny, a sense of calling, a sense of purpose, or whatever. But there's one thing to have a theology of calling. Now that people do need to learn, like, what is that theologically, biblically? Like, what is that? What do we know about it from the scriptures? But it is sort of a little bit of like a skill set or a competency to listen for that, or wonder, or discern that, to discern what that is, hear from the Lord in that way. And that question is the obsession of our community, you know, like, because we would essentially say we don't multiply a tool. We don't multiply a model. We don't multiply a method. You know, we don't sit and try to exegete our city and map out like what the people of God should or shouldn't do. We just want the priesthood of all believers to listen to Jesus and have this vertical encounter about to whom they are sent. Like, what is he asking them to do at this time, in this place, in our moment, in our context? And yeah, and to land it Troas and have a Macedonia dream, right? To like hear from the Lord, like, this is where I should go. So we have some attempts at training toward that, right? So we have this thing called Calling Lab, and that Calling Lab we'll do two or three times a year. We usually do it on a Saturday, and that's where we take both sort of emerging missionary leaders that have not yet had a sense of narrowed clarity about to whom they're sent. Try to be really specific with people. It's not like you don't have a calling and then you come to the Calling Lab and you find one for the first time. It's like you know, I think Hirsch says, like, your baptism is your ordination and your conversion is your commission. So, like, the moment you surrender to Jesus, you have a calling, whether you know it or not. You're called to the revealed will of God in your time and place. You're called to the Great Commission wherever you live, work, and play. All the Calling Lab does is doesn't give you a calling for the first time. It just takes that general calling, and it's like a contemplative listening prayer retreat with the Lord to be like, Lord, do you want to narrow that general calling to land on a specific people for me right now? And that whole Calling Lab day is built around Ephesians 2:10, you know, like, you're God's artwork. You're his masterpiece. And you are created in Christ Jesus for a good work in this season, which he has prepared for you in advance. So it's like, what's the work that you've prepared in advance for me? And part of how I can sort of discern what the answer to that question is wondering, how has he made me? How, as an artwork, as a masterpiece? And so we basically just take people for a morning and say, let's do some spiritual gift tests. Let's do some APEST like learning about how you're wired and what some of your involuntary sort of biases are. Let's do some passion assessment, emotional inventory, like, what gets you fired up? What gets you, you know, that matters. And And then some narrative analysis, like what are experiences that God has brought you through in the past that actually might uniquely qualify you to be an effective witness to people who are in that same experience now? What are groups of people that you have access to that not everybody has access to that matters? So it's like taking all those fresh insight data points from the morning and then basically just having hours in the afternoon to just have a prayer retreat and just lay all that fresh insight before the Lord and say, I see in new ways right now how you've made me. And I think it was your sovereign and some of this might have been with intention. So God, speak to me about to whom I am sent in this time, in this moment. And so we typically tell leader, even if a leader's been through the calling lab before, we usually tell them like, it's sort of like a nice, like a prescription to do that every couple years. Like it's not like a one and done, like I figured it out and move on. And we've got friends there in KC that like the calling lab's not the only tool out there, right? There's like our friends over there in KC, they have like a GPS assessment or something like that. And there's other ones that have your purpose DNA evaluation. So there's a few of those out there, and they all are sort of moving toward the same thing. Like you have, as a priest and the priesthood of all believers, God has an intention for your life. And here's a way to try to discern what that is. But we've also had people that have had a very clear calling and which has been verified by fruit that didn't have anything to do with some of the insights, that it didn't make any sense with the insights that they emerged. So the voice of the Lord doesn't have to like submit to like our cool personality test, right? It's like he can send anybody anywhere, anytime.
You get this specific calling, this more specific than your general calling. You're moving out. How do you start or implement a micro church around it? What is a micro church? And what are you actually galvanizing around? What is the central tenet of a micro church?
So we would, so we have an ecclesial, what's called the ecclesial minimum, which is a theological belief around what are the minimum things that needs to be in place that collide with each other. And that thing is suddenly called church, you know? And we've wanted to be able to clarify that not as a strategic asset or a pragmatic belief, but as like really a theological belief, like what is the church and how do we keep it in its simplest form so that it can multiply in its simplest form? And then they can get more complex as they go, but we have to have an imagination for it in its simplest form. So our ecclesial minimum here locally that we've had for, 15, 20 years now is worship, community, mission. And what we mean by those things, by worship, we mean Romans 12 worship. We mean my life is a fully surrendered living sacrifice as my spiritual act of worship. So we don't mean banging on a guitar, although that's totally good and wonderful and fine. There's a lot of microchurches that do that. But what we mean is like surrender, like a community that is in full surrender to Jesus and costly and sacrificial surrender. And by community, we mean intentional, extended spiritual family, so not see each other once a week and then have like a group chat, but like an interdependent spiritual family, life on life. And by mission, we mean that every microchurch has to intentionally proclaim and demonstrate the kingdom of God to the lost and the poor in some way. And so now how that works out is there's two general types of microchurch. There are mission-specific microchurches, which means the community is gathering around a common people group, cause, or place that they feel called to. A handful of examples of that would be like, there's one called Timothy Initiative that works with men that are coming out of addiction, detox facilities, and they do like whole life discipleship, sort of monastic community, whole life discipleship with this community of guys. And they work on a construction company together during the days and do vocational rehabilitation. And there's one called Urban Youth Justice, which is planting microchurches inside of juvenile detention facilities across 5-county radius. There's one called Everlasting, which is a microchurch that's reaching ultimate frisbee leagues in Pinellas County. There's one called Urban Fellowship that's working with gang youth up in a certain area of town, north Tampa, close to the university. There's obviously some microchurches that are reaching college students. There's microchurches that are adopting schools to do mentor programs. So those are like, it would be hard to join that microchurch if you did not feel a sense of calling to lay your life down to reach those people or that place or that cause. And it's really clear how those start as a sense of calling from a leader. They're actually going to try to get proximity, presence, powerlessness among those people. They're trying to find a people, person of peace. They're trying to see if disciples start to get made and eventually a witnessing community emerges. Then there's distributive microchurches. That's the second kind. Sometimes we call them incubators. So those are people that aren't gathering around a specific people group or place, like a common sense of calling. They're gathering around accountability and encouragement and commitments to shared values and missional life itself, wherever they live, work, and play. You know, so they're not all reaching the same people, but everybody is either trying to pursue or knows their sense of calling and a people that they're trying to reach. And essentially, all those faithful missionaries have not yet seen a church emerge among those people, and you can't just live isolated for a year, 2 years, 3 years. So it's good, it's healthy for them to be in a distributive house church that's made up of people that are trying to be faithful to different pockets. And so I lead a house church right now in my neighborhood, and that one's a distributive, you know, so my wife and I feel very called to our neighborhood. It's called Belmont Heights Estates. It's the largest saturation of government subsidized housing in Tampa Bay. So we live in the projects, and we have a few other sort of believer families that live on our block with us within walking, right? Like we just like go to each other's houses. For a long time, we were a neighborhood house church. So it was mission specific. It's like, you can really only join this house church if you want to reach the neighborhood, and, or if you want to live it, you got to sort of move into the neighborhood. Like that's the only way you join our house church. But then we, you know, after about 3 or 4 years, we pivoted to be distributive because there were so many people in the neighborhood that became part of our house church, but they actually had a sense of calling to somewhere not the neighborhood. And we didn't want to say no to that. We felt like it was important to like support that and breathe on that and make room for that. So yeah, now, you know, my wife does some homeschool co-op stuff in the neighborhood just as a mechanism to do incarnational ministry. And I run a home repair service as a way to do incarnational ministry in the neighborhood. And then there's a couple on our block that does CrossFit ministry. So they run a Discovery Bible study in their CrossFit gym on Thursday nights, and they've been in that gym for a long time. And they're basically just seen as like the pastors of the gym at this point. Like every once in a while, they'll be doing a competition at a, let's let them pray. Let's let the ones over there, they could be the ones that pray to start the competition, you know. And there's a couple that does board gamer ministry because they're in this like niche board gaming community that plays board games I've never heard of in my life. So they do twice a month, they do a board gamer night where everybody comes over, and then they have these conversation cards that they're sort of like pulling throughout the night that has them basically having spiritual conversations around value and worth and life and worldview. And then there's a couple that does college student ministry. There's a couple that does workplace ministry in the towers downtown. So the life of our community is a little weird. Like we have open table Discovery Bible study on Monday nights, and you just never know who's going to be in there. And then Wednesday nights we have like discipled core of our community, like a dinner. And then we have we support each other's outreaches if we need help, you know, come alongside each other. So you've got the ecclesia minimum. It's rigid enough that we don't say everything's a microchurch. Like it's pretty specific. Like there's some things that are microchurch and there's some things that aren't. We've had plenty of people come to us and say, I'm leading this microchurch, can I be part of the network? And we're like, that's not a microchurch. Like, because it has some definition to it, but it has just enough definition that it allows for what we would call adaptive missiology, expansive ecclesiology, right? It's like, there's a little over 160 microchurches right now just in Tampa Bay, and they look every single one of them looks very different. They're using different tools, they have different language, they count different things, because each of those microchurch leaders has quite a bit of freedom to contextualize for the group of people that they're trying to reach, you know. So what they have in common is the ecclesia minimum, a sense of calling that they're doing. The reason that microchurch exists is not because a leader told them they should do it, but because Jesus asked them to do it. And they have just enough values alignment to make sense. That's the Underground Manifesto. They have just enough theological alignment to make sense. That's the creeds, the creedal orthodoxy. But then other than that, they're all very, very different.
So if they're distributed and they're different, you know, you have mission-specific, you have distributive microchurches. How do you connect one to another? I know when I was in the Middle East, we started a bunch of simple churches with Muslim background people. And because of our situation, we actually couldn't really connect smaller house churches together. Like they couldn't really know much about each other. So we were the ones telling stories about other micro churches to say, hey, you're not alone in this. It's not just you. But it does sometimes feel when you're in a small community, which, you know, I'll just give you in Kansas City what we do. I go to a church called Nava Church, KC. We have home churches three times a month. And once a month, we gather all together as all the home churches in the city. We come together. And it really says, hey, we actually are part of a bigger thing. It's not just our community. How do you connect to each other? What does that look like? And how do you get people to know that they belong to something bigger than themselves? And what's the importance of larger connection?
The way that it works for us is that, you know, the underground is simultaneously two things. That's why sometimes it's hard to explain. We call it a dual operating system. On the one side, the underground is a decentralized network of microchurches, and those microchurches have access to an ordination process where they can join the College of Elders. And then of that College of Elders, there's a handful of governing elders, you know, so that all the governance and church discipline and restoration processes and oversight and all that kind of stuff that exists in the decentralized network of microchurches. That network of microchurches is a non-entity. It's not an LLC. It's not a nonprofit. It's not a church. It is just a relational coalition. On the other side, the underground, what I work for, I don't work for that. Nobody works for that. The decentralized network of microchurches. I'm not the executive director of that. I'm part of it. You know, I happen to be a house church leader. I happen to be a sitting governing elder for a season. But what I work for, what I'm the executive director of, is the other side of the underground. It is a nonprofit platform of services which exists, its exempt purpose, to which every dollar, employee, square foot, contract has to be submitted, is to serve that decentralized network of microchurches. Not power over or control or predict or anything like that. It's like we react to what the priesthood of all believers needs. So that's what Tomi Wilkerson and Stacy Gaskins and I, we're a part of like a leadership team that helps oversee that. And they have a bunch of services in there, financial services, media services, coaching, training, facilities and events. All those services are shared, leveraged by the network of churches, whatever they need. It's like a buffet, come and get it. One of those services that the platform offers is convening environments for the network. So because if the decentralized network just sits back and they, exactly like you said, they need to gather, they need to connect, they need to convene. But it can be a little bit distracting for those microchurches. Like who decides who does it and who and then how do they take time out of their microchurch to pull it off? And how do they secure space and how do they secure, like, you know, it's a huge load to carry. So basically the missions agency side basically says we'll help like set the table of convening environments for the sake of the decentralized network. So the missions agency is who secures space and coordination, project management, and then sort of plans, all that kind of stuff, larger convening environments for the movement. The way that works right now is that the movement is broke down into five area collectives, geographic area collectives. Each of those area collectives has their own rhythm of convening. So Central Tampa, that's what I'm a part of. The Central Tampa area meets weekly on Sunday morning. So nobody has their microchurches on Sunday morning. And that's a time when the we have a moment where the microchurches can all convene with each other, or just the leaders can convene. They get to decide. Each microchurch decides if the leader comes or the whole microchurch comes. It's up to them. But we have a Sunday morning moment, which is basically just like a convening of the movement. It's not meant to be this open meeting that anybody can come to. It's sort of like a family meeting. And it's for the sake of coaching and training. And like you said, helping people get a sense that they're a part of a bigger thing, being able to hear what God is doing in other places and learn from that, catch testimonies from each other, be inspired by that, learn from each other, like little secrets, tactics, all that sort of think tank style, all that's critically important. And so they convene in area network, area collectives, and then all those area collectives get together about 6 to 8 times a year for larger events, like a conference or a big testimony or storytelling banquet. We'll do that once or twice a year, microchurch showcase. Those are all. So we do have like a little bit of a movement wide rhythm of life, you know, where it's like you're with your microchurch most often, but then you have some environments with your Eric Collective, and then occasionally you have these environments with the whole movement. And those are for the sake of, like you said, inspiration, encouragement. You're part of a bigger thing. You're relationally connected to other leaders. You're learning from what they're doing. You're seeing what God is doing in a broader way. So we would say that's critically important because in the New Testament, the church isn't just house churches. It's also city churches. And so we're trying to be the church at every level. The way that that Paul and the Jerusalem Council the way that they had an imagination for the church not just being big or just being small, but they had an imagination for church that made room for it to express itself at every level, in homes, in cities, and capital C universal church in unity. And so we're trying to birth a movement where people are walking in the fullness of the church at every level, where they have home church, simple church, small church, but they also have moments to see the manifest city church, and where they even feel connected to global church and care about global church.
So can you talk a little bit about the spaces of belonging in that, if you're looking at what church can do in these different spaces? What are these spaces and why are they important for us to be involved in all of them?
You know, in a quick way, you could say they're important to be in all of them because we see that biblically, the church is expressed in all those, you know, small, medium to large ways, and it's important to live it. But it's really interesting. I'm sure you're familiar with this, but the Hall and Myers is what's in my mind. There was a guy that came out with the 4 Spaces of Belongings in early 2000s. I think his book was called The Search to Belong, and he was a Christian that was applying some theories that was written by a guy back in the 60s on the theory of social belonging. And they came across this way of sociological way of understanding belonging, that people actually need to belong in these four different spaces. And if they only are belonging in one or two of these spaces, they'll start to feel alone or isolated or like they don't quite fully belong. And those spaces were... I think intimate space is the smallest one, 2 to 4, you know, 2 to 4 people where you can actually be totally vulnerable, totally yourself, wide open, fully known and fully know others. And then they have this, the one slightly bigger than that is personal space, which it can be like 5 to 12 people where you can be a part of a broader family. You can share values. You can find the people with whom you can have vulnerable space. You typically don't find vulnerable space until you're a part of personal space. The one slightly bigger than that, social space, is, you know, around 20 to 40 people. And then the broadest space is public space, 75 plus space. And 75 plus space is like you can't know anybody and you can't be known, but you have a room full of strangers that you feel like you have something in common with, because there's like a stadium of Chiefs fans. I'll do a Kansas City reference because you're in Kansas City. You know, it's like you can feel a sense of belonging when you're in a stadium full of thousands and thousands of people and you don't know any of them. You know, that would be like public space belonging. And they essentially did gobs of research on helping realize that you can be a part of public space and social space, but if you don't have any personal space environments or intimate space environments, you'll struggle to feel like you belong. And you'll actually have other sort of social anxieties or social dysfunctions from not being a part of environments like that. In the same way, you could be a part of intimate space and personal space, but if you don't have those other spaces of belonging, for instance, a house church that is not connected meaningfully to a broader citywide community, that can have certain effects on people's sense of belonging. I just think it's hilarious when sociologists give their whole lives studying something and they just discover what's like plainly true in the scriptures. You
know? It's like, this is what Jesus did.
This is what Jesus did, right. It's like he had this inner three, and then he had the 12, and then he like preached, and then he had the 72, and he preached to the crowds or whatever. And it's like, you can see that in the life of Jesus. And then you can see it in the New Testament church, you know, that they had house churches and city churches. And so I think the prevailing model of the church and the legacy models of the church that have sort of helped to solidify an existing imagination of the church as bigger is better, large, mega, attractional, that kind of stuff. Essentially, those are like ready ways to create public spaces of belonging for people. And then typically maybe in those environments, there can be like a little bit of vision casting for like, we have a small group network, you know, whatever. So then there's like some personal space belonging. But these are generalized strokes, right? But a lot of times in those environments, you'll have a hard time finding vulnerable space or social space. And that has certain downsides. But in the same way, like you said earlier, there can be a lot of house church networks that are flush with intimate space and personal space, but you don't have any social or public. And there's downsides to that too. And so I think we're trying to capture a rhythm of imagination that helps us live into all the, not just the, you know, sociological social spaces, but the way that those things actually point to us, the biblical foundations of the manifest church in all of its forms at every fractal.
I was teaching the other week, and I was talking to a bunch of legacy pastors, and you know, we're talking movement, and I think I basically said, if you don't really believe in the priesthood of all believers, it's not going to work. And if you do believe in the priesthood of all believers, it's going to be messy. And yes. Either you want control, and you could have a little bit of control, and you're not going to actually see any movement, or you're going to want some messiness and believe in the priesthood of all believers and go, how can we enter into that space and believe in the priesthood of all believers and be okay with some mess? Because, well, it's going to be messy no matter what. Even if we try to control it, it's going to be messy. So why don't we just give it to somebody
else?
Why
don't we just go for it? Yeah, that's right. You know, sometimes we use the word chaotic sometimes, chaos and order. So, you know, we're always trying to pursue like a chaotic environment that when you believe in the priesthood of all believers and the other side of that coin, when you believe in the priesthood of all believers, is that you also believe that Jesus is the proper head of the church, not us, right? That's the other side of the priesthood of all believers. And so we're actually restoring, whenever we're trying to pursue the activation of the priesthood of all believers, we're also trying to pursue the restoration of Jesus as the proper head of the church and us in our rightful place as, you know, under shepherds or equippers or activators. And that's all, you know, we're just totally losing grip of any version of like control or alignment strategies or, you know, like guardrails and that kind of stuff. And it starts to feel a whole lot like chaos. But there are ways to have just enough order that behind the chaos that does keep it healthy. Chaos doesn't equal healthy. Order doesn't equal healthy. What we want is healthy. So we don't want chaos. We don't want order. What we want is healthy. And healthy looks chaotic. You know, it's sitting in the middle of that tension. It's merging that tension. But man, I agree. There's so many things that, and I've, you know, we've got a high level of collaboration and partnership with a lot of local churches here in Tampa, you know, so we're friends with a part of a broader citywide collaboration of churches, both, you know, prevailing mega historic micro, you know, so we roll with a lot of these guys. And so I empathize with a lot of them, the situation that they're in and how much needs to shift or change and the difficulty of that. It's so difficult, even for the most well-meaning leader and team. But man, it's worth trying. It's worth running after it, you know. We have several friends that are sort of like, yeah, I want to do something that it's essentially like you're saying, I don't think anybody disagrees with the priesthood of all believers.
Right. Yeah.
But I think so many of them are like casting vision from the pulpit for the act of, like, the emergence of the priesthood of all believers, and let's take the church outside the four walls, and like let's all join with God and what he's doing in the city. Everybody's like saying it from the pulpit or saying it from classrooms or whatever, but the culture and structure of the church itself actually competes with the words, you know. And the you know, culture eat strategy for breakfast. You know, you have all these terms that are like you can say with your words and try to do technical solutions to the barriers that you're facing, but you've got to start to address both the structures that are in place that get in the way of that. Some of that's around money, where it goes, where it's spent. Some of it's around decision making and power, who gets to decide. Some of it's around like even the idea of like church vision. What does that even mean if you're trying to activate the priesthood of all believers? Vision is like one leader, like the lead mega global pastor, you know, they're the ones that get to listen to Jesus about their sense of calling. They get to go up the mountain and hear from the Lord, and then they codify that sense of calling into a vision statement. And then they're just trying to align thousands of people to that one vision. So nobody else gets to hear from Jesus. And if they do, and they hear a sense of calling that diverges somehow from this one sense of calling, well, you got to go find somewhere else. You know, so even our sense of like who gets to have a vision, how that vision integrates or doesn't integrate with the sort of scope of the community and our aspirations around alignment, that all gets messy, and it has to be completely rethought. You know, it has to be, you got to count the cost and really negotiate, like, how chaotic are we willing to get? And what are the things we're willing to let go of?
You know, as I've been training and being involved in decentralized networks for many years, there's a couple of things that I get. The number one question is, how do you prevent heresy? All right, that's good.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, the priesthood of all believers. So but I'll let you answer that just
yes.
Briefly. But
yeah.
The other one, I think, is a newer question because we're dealing with it in the church, is how do you prevent abuse in these smaller settings, especially when, you know, it's a family-oriented place where you have young children and families and people. So how do you prevent or help in those situations when you have small groups around the city?
Deal with the first one, the heresy question. You know, a big part of a non-practical part of that answer is essentially like is letting go of our sense of control a little bit, because we have to trust that Jesus can actually, you know, lead the church, and, you know, and that Jesus is able to convict, and the Holy Spirit is able to teach, and that Jesus can actually protect his church from heresy better than we ever could. Now, that's not an abdication of responsibility on our part to be like, we're just like laissez-faire and we don't care about it. But it's essentially us. We on our end, obviously, we have a college of elders, and then we have a governing elder body, and that governing elder body, is an active body that is called into action when there are matters in the leadership of any microchurch that are a breach of the covenant commitments that they've made to the relational network. So that's like moral failures or marriage breakdown or accusations of abuse or theological straying. Those would all constitute breach of covenant commitments, and those would all be situations where the governing elders can jump in and get involved and have healthy church discipline practices and restoration processes. So we have strong governance and we take it really seriously. But at the same time, we're not running around every week and checking in on every microchurch. We're sort of trusting that like God is going to bring things to the attention of the governing elders through coaching or through training or through the relational network when they have gotten to a place where they need responded to. And plenty of examples of that over the last 10 or 15 years of theological straying that required some dialogue and that kind of thing. Now, I think the abuse question is a great question too, you know, and as a side point on both of these, on the heresy and the abuse question, they're easier conversations to have when it's almost like you can acknowledge on the front end that like the prevailing or traditional model of church isn't like a non-heresy, non-abuse setting, and now like we're allowing it over here. It's like, no, there's plenty over here that we have never been able to figure out how to prevent or something like that. So it's almost like, yeah, we're there. It exists in both places and it looks different ways. But so, yeah, we in the same way, this is another reason why it's important for house churches, simple churches, micro churches to not remain in isolation. They abuse can be prevalent when something is advocated as a simple church or house church and it's not in submission to anything outside of itself. You have no recourse if something happens inside that house church and there's no checking or oversight or governance. Anything that is not in submission to something else is already unhealthy. Even if internally there isn't something that's like clearly unhealthy yet, if it is in isolation and not in submission in any way to something outside of itself, it is unhealthy. And so that's why we've tried it, that even the idea of decentralized network is important, that these things are actually a part of something bigger and a part of the front door of being part of that something that something bigger is making very clear covenant commitments to the relational network around character and conduct and how you will lead. And so we have that. We have a leader's covenant that every single microchurch sees and discerns and reads and agrees to. And if they can't agree to it, they can't be a part of our network. And in that, there's a section in there around like your personal spiritual life. Like I'm going to maintain a vibrant prayer life. I am going to be pursuing, you know, I'm going to exemplify the characters of an elder as laid out in Timothy and Titus. But there's a section around how you will lead. It's like, I am not going to exploit my people at any time for personal gain. I am going to lead in radical generosity. If I'm ever in conflict with another person or another leader, I am going to be in submission to the Matthew 18 processes and a commitment to reconciliation and restoration and mediation if necessary. So we lay all that out and have people agree to it. And there's a line in those documents that say, if I am ever found to be in breach of these commitments, I will submit to the leadership of the governing elders in my life. You know, so if they ever do have an accusation against them, and then the governing elders come and show up at their door and say, hey, we're here to talk about that. And they're like, when did I ever invite you to be a part of this? We can say, remember when you did. We also do, I mean, we live in the year 2024, right? So we also obviously do background checks for every single microchurch leader. We have child protection policies that are on file. And we, you know, those are things that are like important for any organization right now in the world we live in.
Yeah. No, that's really good. I think, you know, I think everybody that is in this decentralized space are starting to realize, if they haven't yet, oh, we really have to figure this thing out.
Yes.
And so that's really good. You know, Lucas, I wish we had at least another hour so I could just go deep into what does it look like? How do we multiply things? Yeah. I'd love to get into the multiplication. So maybe we'll have to do that another time.
Part two.
But so the couple questions I usually ask at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
One, if you could go back to your 21-year-old self, what advice would you give?
Ooh, 21-year-old self, what advice would I give? Yeah, I think I would tell my 21-year-old self to take very seriously and make more room for the contemplative disciplines. Sabbath, solitude, you know, I went too long in my younger years, thinking those things were either optional, or if I did pursued them sort of in a legalistic or like rote way, you know, if I did take a Sabbath, it was sort of like just lay on the couch and watch Netflix. Which isn't a Sabbath, you know. It's like just this like rote definition of like don't work, but. I think trying to figure out earlier in my life what is rest for me, what is restful for me, and trying to discern that with the Lord, and then have that invade Sabbath rhythms for me, and then, you know, modeling my solitude and contemplation, my practices of spiritual formation a little bit more around some of my self-discovery around Enneagram and some of that stuff, like. My spiritual disciplines don't have to look the same as everybody else's in the world, but I sort of need to pay attention to the growth edge of my spiritual formation and to really press into disciplines that intersect the structuring of my soul right now. You know, I wish I would have paid more attention to that in my 20s. Yeah,
that's really good. That's good. What have you been reading or watching? Anything you could recommend?
I just read a book called Art of Asking by Amanda Palmer, I think is her name. Secular book, not Christian. A content warning. There is like some stuff in there that's like not super Christian. You know, I found it very fascinating. Like just as an Enneagram 3 personally that like wants to like go out and accomplish and be interdependent. I'm a, you know, rural Midwestern family, like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do everything on your own. You know, I found that book. I have a really hard time leaning on people, asking for help. I have a really hard time depending on a team, working through a team. And so I just found a lot of the insights in that book really breathtaking, just around the art of asking for help. And it is actually one of the building blocks of relationship and community. When you don't ask for help and you're self-dependent, any of these things are like self-evident. But the way she told that book was laid out in story was really winsome for me. So that was great. And watching, I pretty much just watch The Office and Parks and Recreation and Ted Lasso on repeat. I don't really watch much else, you know. but I do think Ted Lasso, you know, the other two are just sort of like guilty pleasures, but Ted Lasso is a great show that demonstrates the systems theory. If you ever look into, if you listen to Managing Leadership Anxiety or read the book or see any of Steve Cuss's stuff on how anxiety doesn't just affect people, it affects communities and it hijacks communities. And then what does it mean for a well-differentiated leader to bring health to an unhealthy system? Ted Lasso is just a brilliant example of, I think, differentiated leadership in our time.
I agree. It's great. Well, Lucas, thank you so much for this conversation. I love getting into microchurches, a little bit of your story. How do we believe in the priesthood of all believers? How do we not have things chaotic and not have things controlling, but we could actually lean into something where there's a tension that could actually birth the spirit of God within our networks and movements. And, you know, I love the going from general calling to specific callings for people and to say, hey, these are the people that God has called me to. I'm going to galvanize around that. And we're going to have a group of people say, let's go and bring a community of followers of Jesus into this space and see what God does because he's moving. And your thing of saying, hey, where is God moving? And let's join him in what he is doing, I think is absolutely critical and crucial that we don't follow a method, but we actually follow God and the Spirit as he moves. So, Lucas, thank you for this. It was fantastic.
Thank you, brother. Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you want to see more episodes like this,
go to patreon.com/shiftingculture and become a monthly patron of the show. You can help us produce more episodes so that we can see the body of Christ look more like Jesus. If you become a patron on patreon.com/shiftingculture, you will get early access to episodes. You will get episode guides. You will get bonus shows, hopefully, and more. So go to patreon.com/shiftingculture and become a monthly patron. Also, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out and helps us find new listeners to the show. And just go and share this podcast with your friends, your family, your network, people that you think would enjoy it as well. Thank you again for listening to the show. I hope you have a great week.